me.
Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Oh, good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. I'm here with both Kirk and JB. And guys, we're going to take a little turn. It's a bit unexpected, although we did talk about it at length at the end of our program last week. And rather than just continuing a pace through volume two of Observations for Our Time, we're going to jump ahead to the second to last chapter of it, which isn't even completely done, but over the next week I think it'll be completed. It was a chapter that I wrote 5 years ago, and at the time I think the chapter topped off at about 50 pages, and as it stands right now it's 101. So it's been a little more than just your standard rewrite as I've gone through this material. And the reason I think, Kirk, you in particular wanted to jump ahead to it is that it's so relevant for our time.
Absolutely.
It is. It depicts events as they are transpiring now and will transpire over the next 10 years. And it sets all of the major events in context. It tells us who the players are, what's going to happen, when these things are going to happen. Even talks about the timing of the fulfillment of the Teruah harvest and what will be the first phase of World War III, where it will break out and what kind of events are going to transpire around the world. And it has lots of merit because this kind of future history, recognizing what we're going to read, was committed to writing 2,700 years ago. We have a copy of it, an entire copy of it, dating 2,200 years ago. And so we have absolute proof that this was written down as we're going to study it 22 centuries ago. So we have a stand record. And yet, the events, I don't think it would even be possible for someone to envision them happening prior to about 10 years ago. And now it's the fait accompli. So this is something that if you are an informed and rational person and you are confronted with this information, you will no longer be a believer. You will no longer have to put your faith in a God that you do not know or that has not proven his existence. You just flat out know. And you not only know that he inspired this, that he exists and he inspired these texts, you're going to know what he is opposed to, the consequence of being his foe and a foe to his people. You're going to know what's going to happen so you can avoid it. You're going to know when it's going to happen so you can plan for it. This is really an extraordinary series of predictions. So let's go ahead and begin. It begins with the words that indicate that this is a revelation in history. This happens to be future history. It's a masa. It's a prophetic pronouncement regarding a prophecy designed to encourage partiality by being discriminated. A timely declaration regarding a future burden or hardship being removed and lifted away that is carried out of the way. And most of the time when we're confronted by the Hebrew word for prophecy, it's nabi. That just means to make a statement about future events in the past. That's nabi. This wasn't nabi, it was masa. And masa is a prophetic pronouncement, but it's a prophetic pronouncement about something where God is saying, I want you to be partial. I want you to be biased here. I want you to be discriminated. I want you to be judgmental about what you're going to hear. There's a real burden and hardship in this, but there's also a great liberation, an emancipation in it, too, depending on what side of this equation you're going to be on. So a prophetic pronouncement that encourages partiality regarding Damascus. Well, Damascus is the capital of Syria. It's the predicted epicenter of World War III. It's from Dama, which means weeping sore. Dima, which means tears of sorrow. Domen, which means corpses covered in dung. And Damon, to grow dumb and to be silenced. And it is spelled a little bit differently in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And as a result of that spelling, you could also say that it is similar to Daron, which means contemptible and abhorrent, and Darban, which is to goad or prod. Now, that's important. Because there's a lot of things that are interwoven into the concept of Damascus. Remember when Abraham didn't get it in the covenant, he didn't have a kid, and God was saying, I'm going to give you this wonderful inheritance, and Abraham said, God, I know that I don't have a kid. So if you want to give me an inheritance, I'm climbing up there and you're 100 years old, and I don't have a kid, so an inheritance ain't going to do me any good, won't do my offspring any good. So I got this great idea. I got this this worker. And he's from Damascus. Can he be the heir of the covenant? It'll all work out fine. And what did God say about the lad from Damascus?
No deal.
No. No way. This guy from Damascus, he ain't going to be part of the covenant. And then I recall that a couple thousand years later, there's this fellow named Shaul, and he was out being religious and bludgeoning all people that didn't agree with his religion, which at the time was Pharisaic Judaism. And on the road to Damascus, by his own testimony, he was blinded. He was made lame. And he heard the words of Dionysus. And in that he went then to Damascus, where he was coached up on all things religious. So the plague of death was born in Damascus.
In Damascus.
Absolutely. So a prophetic pronouncement regarding Damascus. Behold, that means pay attention. Damascus is revolting and corrupt. And it's going to be removed from inhabited cities. And she shall actually become a twisted and tangled heap of fallen buildings and rubble. Well, revolting and corrupt and removed from inhabited cities, to your men ear, is me going to be rejected and abolished as a population center. The city will be abandoned after enduring anguish and terror because this agonizing ass of a town is displeasing. It was written in the Hopeful Stem, which indicates this fate was foisted upon Damascus, and as a participle, which means Damascus will come to embody this unrestrained corruption. You know, it's, the world of Islam has had its share of really disgusting potentates. But Bashar al-Assad is, and his father, about as bad as they come. They have felt no compulsion about using nerve gas and completely eradicating an entire town of people, men, women, and children, just because they viewed them as a threat. This is one really disgusting dictator. And it'd be hard to imagine a war more convoluted than the one that we're witnessing surrounding Damascus. You got the United States arming terrorists to attack the dictator of the country. You've got Russia arming the dictator and fighting against the terrorist America is arming. Now, I would say that's a recipe for disaster, if that weren't enough. But you've got America arming and directing the Kurds, whom fellow NATO nation Turkey is plundering and bombing and doing everything they can with American weapons to destroy, to obliterate the very people America is arming and using in this war. Of course, you got Europe controlled by the United States, and you got China now siding with Russia. And on top of all that, what you have in Syria is this grand demonstration of the descendants of Ishmael. Remember, his brother's hand will be raised against him, and his hand will be raised against his brother, and he will live in hostility with the whole world. Well, in Islam, Shiite Muslims and Sunni Muslims hate one another more than they hate infidels. And that whole war is Sunni via Shia. And it's a war, Sunni via Shia, that America started by invading Iraq and giving Iraq to Iran, which made Iraq essentially a Shiite nation, changing the balance of power in the Islamic world so that you've got nations like Saudi Arabia arming and abetting the Sunni terrorists so that they can attack and obliterate the Shia terrorists like Hezbollah.
Yeah.
And because Iran is involved controlling Syria through Hezbollah, you've got China on the side of Iran because of all the pipelines they have to the Caspian Sea. What you have in this war is all of the underpinnings of World War III. And at this point, I think it's unavoidable. And you've got America flying bombing missions over Russian troops. And Russian troops fighting on behalf of Syria that are being brought down by Turkish missiles. And America aiding both Turkey and Turkey's mortal enemy, the Kurds. And come to find out, America started the daggone war.
Yeah.
Deliberately. And then exacerbated it with the invasion of Iraq. So, that in itself is pretty stark. And then you read that it's going to be, that Damascus is going to be a Ma'i. Well, Ma'i means twisted and tangled. At the time this was written, was there any material that could be twisted and tangled?
Not those.
Maybe hemp, you know, for rope.
Yeah,
horse hair for rope.
No.
But in terms of a building material?
No.
No, at this time, there were two building materials, right? Maybe three. You know, adobe, which is simply earth, water, and, you know, pounded together in a kind of sun-dried mud, right? stone if you were going to build something of quality that would have any enduring nature, and wood.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the three. Am I missing something?
Well, concrete. I mean, you almost said concrete, so.
I didn't have concrete. The Romans invented concrete.
Pretty easy.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, the Romans invented concrete in around, 200, between 1 and 200 CE?
About that, yeah.
Yeah, so this was written. Yeah, this was written back there in 700 BCE.
So, not, you know.
Almost 1,000 years before concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And so, even if it were concrete, did they have rebar?
No, sir.
No. Was the rebar put in the stones?
No, sir.
Until there was this thing called rebar, you could not have a twisted and tangled heap of ruins. Wood didn't twist and tangle. Wood didn't. Stones didn't. Adobe didn't. And even until quite recently, with the use of rebar, concrete didn't either. So it's a distorted and crooked mound and a perverted and controlled pile from Allah to bend, to twist, to distort of falling buildings and rubble. Now, it's a lot of things are amazing about this. Of all the cities of the world, you know which one is the longest continually inhabited on Earth?
Damascus.
All right. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to pick a city and say, by the way, this one is going to be no more, wouldn't it be the most profound to pick the city that's been occupied and inhabited the longest?
That's pretty amazing.
Well, that'd certainly be a omen.
Yeah, and then recognize that Aleppo and Homs surround Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at any internet presentation of Homs and Aleppo, what are you going to see?
Twisted, just as it's described here.
Twisted heaps of metal.
Exactly. Yeah. Twisted and fallen buildings. Rubble. And the same thing would be true with the Iraqi cities like Fallujah and Mosul. There's just nothing but twisted ruins. And so we're seeing this transpire in cities with million-person populations. And it's inevitable for Damascus. The suburbs of Damascus are already destroyed. It's just a matter of time before the city center, Damascus. And, you know, I was wondering when I first dealt with this, how in the world is the world going to hold off, or these warring factions going to hold off, so that Damascus is destroyed sometime in 2024, 25, more likely 2026, or even 2027?
Yeah, Obama was going to blow
it. Because if it happens before then, the prophetic timeline's all off.
Mm-hmm.
So Damascus has to have a reprieve, you know, 2019 right now. We need a 6-7 year reprieve. And so that's what we're witnessing. And I think we also have to keep in mind that this 17th chapter commences one word away from the 16th chapter where Moab, those of a questionable father, were being described, and Moab, we see its demise, and so we're talking future events. So Damascus here is being presented as the fulcrum upon which future history is going to pivot. It's going to take a dark, deceitful, destructive, and deadly turn. And Damascus is... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, in this very verse, when I did it today, Napala, to just mm-hmm. burn, is it simple?
Mm-hmm.
And then you picked up that it was Nafal, and to fall down, to lie down, to prostrate oneself, be cast down. And then that's from Pilal, which is to pray. And then I say, well, wait a minute. In the fall, we've done this before, and that's from Nephilim, associated with Nephilim, which is these animalistic men who, without a Nesama, got a Nesama, but became so evil that Yahweh couldn't protect them. That's the Noah story. It's just, so if there's any doubt who he's talking about, and if that's not Islam, I don't know who it is. I mean, so this whole verse, everything in it, points directly to exactly as is being translated here by you. I mean,
yeah, Islam. Yeah, there is a degree of intermingling that goes on, which strongly suggests that Christians are being brought into the fray.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we know that the Torahless one is going to be equal parts socialist, secular, humanist, Christian, and Muslim. But there is definitely an intermixing going on here. The belligerents are almost universally Muslims. They're jihadists, and for anyone, and we're going to make that claim all the way through, because the text and the conditions all dictated, but the concluding statement at the end of the chapter is just, these are Islamic terrorists. And then we're going to read other things that pertain to this time and other places and the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and they all point exactly in the same direction. Now, there was another, you know, we've talked about the first three things that make this so interesting, is that, you know, Damascus represents the worst of the human experience. It's not only the world's longest continuously surviving human habitation. Yahweh calls it revolting. You know, and it's true that Abraham's servant, a child of Damascus, was the first person expressly forbidden from even the possibility of participating in government. He said, absolutely and unequivocally no. And 2,000 years thereafter, the world's most pervasive plague, Pauline Christianity, was inspired on the road to Damascus. When a Jew turned Roman conspired with Satan to nullify the covenant with Abraham, to discredit Yahweh's testimony and negate the Mikre that Yahushua had fulfilled. You know, I made we go through this chapter, I made a comment because there is an overt reference to Rome and the Roman Catholic Church in the text. And there's a number of overt references to Shaul. And when you read it, you're wondering, okay, these are talking about Muslims. Why are we talking about Shaul, Paul? And one of the things you find is that, if you're thoughtful about it, Islam doesn't exist without Paul. Paul may be more essential to Islam than Muhammad was. If Paul didn't negate Yahweh's Torah, if he didn't negate Yahusha's fulfillment of Pesach, Batzah, Bekodim, and Shavuah, if he didn't negate the original and only covenant, if he didn't hide Yahweh's name and predilection for Hebrew, if he didn't go on a vicious attack against Israel and Yahudim, Islam doesn't get out of Yathra, much less Mecca. The claims it makes would be so ludicrous, they are so ludicrous, that in a world that wasn't poisoned by Paul's pen, Islam is stillborn. So he made it possible. Fifth, the world's most deadly religion, speaking of Islam, was unified, codified, and ruled from Damascus almost immediately after Muhammad's death. It was during this period that Muslims murdered nearly half of the world's population, plundering the known world. Today, Damascus is the epicenter of world conflict. calling America's ill-advised and counterproductive invasion of Iraq. It is not only from Syria that the world's largest, most transformational, and most anti-Semitic migration has commenced. Damascus has divided the world into warring factions with Sunni and Shia Islam. Between the United States and Europe on one side, along with the Kurds, and Shia Islam, Russia, China, and the Turks on the other. So, does Damascus appear, we might ponder, in this pivotal text on the way of man versus the plan of God? For all six of the reasons we've just mentioned, for some of them, none of them, or is this simply future history being reported for our edification? In other words, is it man who has taken us there by focusing his rage on this place? And I caught. Are the events being foretold that are going to occur in Damascus because this is where the ways of man, the choices man has and will make, take us? Or did God choose it to reveal all these interesting insights to us? What do you think? I mean, it's really an interesting question in terms of perspective.
Well, it's a little like chicken and egg. I mean, you've got a lot of reasons where the master becomes that epicenter, and then you've got, then history kind of goes away from there for a while because there's a forum. Nobody paid attention, and you got the oil comes back, so we're back in the Middle East, and that's where Syria plays a part all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, so it was.
Yeah, I think both are true.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Damascus is the perfect place. It's for the epicenter of World War III, and all these things come together. It gives us such an opportunity to think and to plan and understand. So.
You know, what you've reviewed so far.
Yeah, and when God, the very fact that God takes the time to tell us that Damascus was pure, revolting and corrupt and will be removed, says far more than this is just man being man. So this is really an interesting, it's an interesting beginning, and we're literally witnessing it happening before our eyes. Abandoned and forsaken will be the inhabited and terrorized regions of Aurora, which is the repudiated outcast. For there will be roaming animals fighting and militant militias along with their helpers. But they will cease and crouch down because there will be no one left to terrorize. Again, powerful. So abandoned and forsaken is off. That's as bad as it gets in Hebrew. And he's saying it's not just Damascus, but the inhabited and terrorized regions, the Ur, of Aurora. Now, Aurora means the land of the exiles. Who are the most famous exiles on the planet today?
The so-called Palestinians.
Is there any? Is there even a remotely close second?
No.
Now, I'm not even aware of anybody in today's world that we think of as exiles from their homeland, other than the Palestinians. And of course, what's amazing is not only when you talk about exiles and the right of return, not only does your mind, everyone's mind has been conditioned to go to the Palestinians, in their case, it's not even true.
Yeah.
And there are no Palestinians. There is no Palestine. And it's not their home. But they have put on this badge, and they wear it proudly. And so the repudiated outcasts, Palestinians. Now, what's interesting is in the Arnon Valley in Ammon, Jordan, that is where millions of these so-called Palestinians live.
Mm-hmm.
So, abandoned and forsaken will be the inhabited and terrorized regions of Aor, the repudiated outcast. One of the things that very few people recognize is that Muslims the world over use the mythical fate of the mythical people known as Palestinians. They're actual people. They're just the Palestinian connections, pure myth, to advance their singular most unifying cause, which is the destruction of Israel. But you know what's interesting? Muslims almost universally hate the so-called Palestinians. And for lots of reasons.
There's a reason they won't let them into their country.
There's a reason that there is no state of Palestine in Saudi Arabia where they've got way too much land. Or in the Sinai. Or any place in Egypt. That's why they're the majority population of Jordan, and yet they don't have a homeland carved out of Jordan. No shortage of land there. Nobody wants them. You know, before UN 242, before Israel was formed as a nation, and Jordan controlled the West Bank, the Jordanians say, oh, you poor Palestinians. And here you are in the West Bank of what we're calling Jordan at this point. We ought to give you a homeland, and that's yours. Why don't we just rename it? It'll be your home. Did the Jordanians do that?
Nope.
Some refugee camp.
How about Gaza? Gaza was under the control of Egypt. Did the Egyptians say, oh my God, we got these displaced peoples, these exiles, and these poor, wonderful Palestinians in Gaza, the right thing to do is give them a country. Let's just give Gaza to them. The Egyptians do that?
Nope.
No.
Nobody.
No. Muslims don't like them. They haven't liked them ever.
Oh,
the PLO is not a popular organization anywhere in the Islamic world. So that, what this says is abandoned and forsaken will be the inhabited and terrorized of Aor, the reputed outcast. Muslims want Israel destroyed. If they can use a myth to accomplish that, they'll do so. But they're not doing it on behalf of the so-called Palestinians. For there will be roaming animals fighting in militant militias along with their helpers, Adar. Unified jihadists gathered together with their helpers. Ansar, you know how many terrorist organizations are Ansar this, Ansar that? Well, Ansar is what Muhammad, who was really caste sensitive, the Meccans and his particular clan in Mecca, that was the highest caste. And then the average rank and file of Mecca was the next caste down. And then when he went to Yathrib, the pagans in Yathrib that became Muslims weren't considered on the same playing field, the same league as the Meccans. So they were just called helpers. They were Ansar, helpers. And that's what this word means. So the militant militias along with their helpers, it is a direct reference to Islam and the terrorist groups that identify themselves as the helpers. You know, the helpers of the Quran, the helpers of Allah. And they will cease and crouch down because there will be no one left to terrorize. It's two things. There are not a lot of militants out there, terrorists, that crouch down, but that's exactly what Muslims do. They can be in the middle of fighting their hellish battle, and when the gong says go, they're down prostrating themselves. Kalashnikov off to the side. You know, prayer mat under their knees, all lined up with Mecca. That's just who they are. And that's a reference here as well. And then it says there'll be no one left to terrorize. You know, the largest human migration is the one that we just witnessed that is still ongoing.
Yeah.
Of Muslims leaving Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, at all, flooding into Europe. They're taking the poison with them. It's like having Ebola and just being allowed to walk into to civilian centers, except Islam is vastly more deadly than Ebola. There are treatments for Ebola. There are no treatments for Islam. And Islam is the most anti-Semitic religion in the world. It is going to fundamentally, if it hasn't already, change Europe such that the European nations are going to be as anti-Semitic as are the Muslim nations. You know, it's not long, and there'll be no one left to terrorize. And what's an Islamic jihadist going to do if there aren't little girls to rape? If there's no one left to rob? You know, if you can't earn jihad points by going off and killing somebody. But that's what this says. And with the migration out of that country, it is absolutely and entirely possible. So it says the fortified city. Well, I don't know if there's a city that's more fortified in the world right now than Damascus. So the fortified city will cease to exist because of, on the account of, Ephraim, along with the government out of Damascus, including the remnant of Aram, which is Syria, for being similarly vehement and burdensome. So, why do you think it's in Ephraim's interest that Damascus is done? Are you ready? Well, think of Ephraim. Ephraim represents the northern kingdom. Right. That's the part of Israel that is closest to this southern border of Syria. So it is the northern kingdom that is less susceptible to Syrian attack if the Syrian military is no more, because it's the Syrian military that almost carried the day in the Yom Kippur War. They were using Russian tanks and Russian airplanes, and with a surprise attack, the Syrian military almost turned the tide, and it was a divine miracle that Israel survived the 1974 Yom Kippur War. But if Damascus falls, there are no Russian weapons. You know, the Islamic State tried to run some armored weapons briefly when they captured Mosul and the like, but it doesn't work in a jihadi kind of way, because those things are, you know, the whole thing about jihad and terrorism is that your armed group, you strike in and you feed into the civilian population, so you're really hard to kill. But if you're riding around in a tank with all of the aerial weapons and reconnaissance that America has, you might as well just blow yourself up. You're not going to survive it. So with the Syrian government gone, Ephraim, the northern part of Israel, is no longer vulnerable to them. And it's no longer vulnerable then to conventional weapons. And when you look at the attacks, the three wars fought against Israel, I mean, the most formidable foe was always the Syrians, because of the nature of their military and the fact that it was supplied with Russian weapons. So if Damascus falls, that threat's gone away. So it is for the benefit of Ephraim that Damascus falls, along of Damascus, you also have the fall of Syria. And, you know, God's making it real clear that the most fearsome enemy of Israel these past 40 years has been Syria, because of their weapon systems and the coordinated attacks that they've launched against the nation. This is the children of Israel shall continue to exist. Prophetically declares, this is just Nahum, pronounces in advance of it occurring, you know, of the vast array of spiritual messengers and envoys. So with Syria gone as an independent country, and therefore you no longer have a military there wielding Russian weapons, Israel's going to survive. And that's really the thing that God wants most of all. He does not want Israel destroyed. He doesn't have a problem with, I think, well, he has a problem with it, but when nations attack Israel, God allows those attacks up to the point that they became overly burdensome, and then he almost always seeks retribution against those who perpetrate them. It's just, you know, that's what loving parents do. They allow their child to grow and to figure it out and to recognize the consequence of their mistakes up to the point where those mistakes become fatal. And they step in, and they always try to hold the perpetrator accountable. And that is precisely what's going to happen with Syria, Damascus, and with Israel.
Well, let me ask you this. When Damascus falls, and you write in here that you believe that Iran may give them a little nuke job before they finish, just to say, just to wipe out Syria a little bit more completely. That's scary. I mean, I understand what you're saying about Ephraim. I understand what Yahweh's saying about Ephraim. It's a postponing, obviously, that'll make the timeline because of this. But if you were aware at all, you'd be nervous as all get out at the end of this thing because of what's happened so far. Remember, you've stated this, and we've observed it all, is when the terrorists attack, and then everything is over with, like Afghanistan, and they go home. Somewhere else again. So that's
correct.
You know, it's just a calm before the big storm, is to me.
Right.
So that's kind of where
the jihadists all culminated, accumulated in Afghanistan when they were fighting the great jihad against the Russians, American weapons, of course. And then they were able in Afghanistan to fight another great jihad against the great Satan in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
When we invaded Afghanistan, they could not engage in the battle in terms of the imported jihadists in Iraq because of the fact that Saddam Hussein would tolerate fundamentalist Islamic terrorists. So they created some homegrown both Shiite and Sunni terrorists to fight America there. And, you know, when they had the great jihad going in Libya, they came from all over the world.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and then look at as things transpired in Iraq, the next great opportunity for jihadists was in Syria. When Syria falls, where do you think they're going to go?
Well, now they have to turn, either go home for a little while, or they turn immediately down to Lebanon, crossing Lebanon and Jordan. Now.
Yes, and to
Israel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, this is going to continue to build. Now, what's interesting is this, within this context of rebuke of the belligerents, we should never lose sight of the fact that the United States outspends Russia and China combined by 3-1 militarily. We outspend Russia and China combined by 3-1 militarily. America squanders $750 billion on its war machine. while just $250 billion is spent annually by Assad's allies, the combined forces of Russia and China. Puts things into perspective, but $1 trillion spent on weapons of death by the three dominant actors in the Syrian war. But we have our priorities straight, don't we? Now, this is what's interesting. I just thought for an alternative but inaccurate perspective. This is what the King James Version renders from that last statement that we read. Now, the last thing we read reads that, therefore, the fortified city and its defensive structures will cease to exist on account of Ephraim, synonym for Yisrael, apart from Yehuda, along with the government of Damascus, including the remnant of Syria and Assyria, today's Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, for being similarly vehement and burdensome, fanatical and onerous, dim-witted and enraged. The children of Israel, those individuals who engage and endure with God, shall actually continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh, the vast array of spiritual messengers and envoys. So this is how they dealt with in the King James. The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria. They shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith the Lord of hosts.
Well, maybe from the Lord of hosts.
Yeah,
maybe the Lord.
But they've got Ephraim ceasing.
I know.
How in the world is Yahweh going to reconcile his covenant relationship with Israel and Yehuda if Ephraim ceases?
They're making sense.
And what kind of a fortress is there around Ephraim now to make that possible?
None.
Well, but we can always turn to the New Living Translation, the NILT. It says, fortified towns of Israel will also be destroyed, and the royal power of Damascus will end. All that remains of Syria will share the fate of Israel's departed glory. Wow. That's what Christians want. That's the Christian dream. Israel's destroyed so that their former glory is given to their church. But the words don't say this. And that's what not... You know, if you look at what Yahweh is predicting is going to happen over the final 7 years, the time of Jacob's trouble, is that the world's going to, in a unified fashion, plan and plot against Israel, then Israel at the waist, and then root every manner of jihadist and militant on as they deploy massive weapon systems and try to destroy Israel. Such that Yahweh has to intervene, and that he ultimately reconciles his relationship with Israel and Yehuda on the basis of the Torah. That's the story. There's only one story. That's the story. So how can you write such rubbish in the most recent translations that the fortified towns of Israel are the ones that are going to be destroyed? And the royal power of Damascus will end. And all that remains of Syria will share the fate of Israel's departed glory. Wow. Just no correlation between the words and what they've written. And it shall actually come to pass in that day. Now this is amazing to me. That the size of Jacob shall be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable or viable. And the fattest, best protected, and most important place of his body shall be laid.
242.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know if there is another nation ever that was put in this position. They didn't lean Czechoslovakia at the waist. They just cut it in two. This specifically says that Israel's going to be thinned at the waist. And that the fattest, best protected, and most important place of the bodies still strength. Sacrificed, if you will. So it's not only that that's the way that Israel is laid out, that 70% of her population and all of the best resources in Israel are concentrated in her midsection between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. That if you look at the Gaza-West Bank combination, with Gaza already given to the Muslims and the West Bank promised to them, we're in a position right now where the Land for Peace Treaty that's being proposed by the world does this exact thing.
Mm-hmm.
It sends Israel at the waist to the point where it's 5 to 10 miles wide at the waist, which makes the nation completely and totally unstable and vulnerable.
If the United States hadn't done this to Israel, offering the West Bank prematurely or on record in the United
right.
Nations, and had they not, and Bush's wonderful crowd hadn't given away
Gaza,
nobody else in the world is going to them and said, you have to give this up.
There's no other country in the world that can afford to give Israel but Gaza of the United States. And even recently with Trump, he says, I'm not all for the two-state solution. Well, first of all, two states is not a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And the promise of land to people that have too much of it for a commitment of peace from people who have never known it has got to be the dumbest, most ignorant idea ever foisted on humankind. Yeah, and Trump's now in favor of it. Obama was obviously in favor. In fact, he tried to rally world opinion such that it was
incomplete.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
It is inevitable. It is going to happen. This says it's going to happen. We can't stop it from happening, but we can speak out against it. We can warn the world that this is a really stupid thing to do, and by the way, you're going to piss off God. And doing so, that's a really bad idea, too. This puts you on the wrong side of history. And one of the things we're going to find as we go through this presentation
mm-hmm.
is that we're moving into a period where there will no longer be choice. Where you will have your fate determined by whose side you're on when these events begin to transpire. The world's coming to an end as we know it. And God's not going to allow the free will experiment to go on forever, because if he were to, right up to the last minute, engage people, that we're just on the wrong side until 30 seconds before he returns. I know, I want to change sides. God, then we would fill heaven with some really desperate but despicable people.
Well, then the fight
isn't going to happen. So we are moving towards, we're not there, and I don't think we'll be there for another 7 years or more, but we are moving towards a period where your fate will no longer even allow that third option, that option of your soul ceasing to exist. It's either going to go to Shamaim or Sheol. So this is really important. You make certain you and those that you love are on the right side of this equation at the right time. And the right time would be now. So I don't think you could have a more adroit, specific prediction of world events than what we read right here. And it shall come to pass in that day that the size of Jacob, which is the totality of Israel, shall be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable or viable, and the fattest, best protected, and most important place of his body shall be lain. And I say that because I don't think there's any country in the history of the world who has occupied a parcel of land for this long. I don't think there's anyone who have faced the kind of enemies that Israel has. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon. Yeah. The Greeks, the Romans. And you know, the Hittites, the Amalekites. And then, of course, the Muslims and the Roman Catholics. And then the Nazis. Then the Soviets. It just goes on and on and on and on and on. And yet, this group of people representing 0.2% of the world's population, they still exist. And they have their own country back. Because if at any time they were like the Philistines and wiped out, the Hittites and wiped out, the Assyrians and wiped out, the Babylonians and wiped out, the Carthaginians and wiped out, if they were like any of these other nations, you know, even with Rome and Italy, they're Italians now, they're not Romans. There is no other nation ever that's endured this long and returned to their homeland. And if without that, the prophecy doesn't work. And the odds against that have got to be 1 billion to 1. And then on top of that, it's got to be a nation that can be fended to waste, and there has to be a valid explanation of how that's going to occur. That's 100% of what the world is trying to do with Israel. That's UN 242. Dissect in the middle. This is the consequence of giving Gaza away and the West Bank. And it is exactly as depicted here. It's, again, it's the plan of almost every world leader. And you put the whole thing together of this just happening and being able to be predicted 2,700 years ago is breathtaking. But it does puts Israel in a place that's completely and totally unsustainable. In the chapter on this, I kind of go through the history of this and talk about nations and what they have done to Israel, and it's because you need to drive the point home that okay, just because we're reading this and it's reading like tomorrow's newspaper, think of the probability or the lack of probability that all this was going to transpire this way. Billions and billions to one.
Proves Yahweh again.
Yeah, now, how many of them are there?
Seven.
How many have been fulfilled?
Four.
Were they fulfilled in order?
Yes.
Yes.
Right days in order. In fact, those first four were fulfilled in the fourth millennia of Yah's calendar, year 4000. Correct?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's the next one that in the order of fulfillment?
We have
Teruah.
Teruah. And Teruah, we have every indication, is going to happen such that the children of the covenant are kept out of the time of Jacob's troubles, but yet are allowed to remain as long as possible because Yahweh wants his children to have the information they need to make the right decision, because the whole purpose is to reconcile his relationship with them. So we shouldn't be surprised, then, should we, if the next thing we learn is that after the fall of Damascus and the fall of Syria and the thing of Israel at the waste, which is that Daniel peace treaty that's affirmed with Benny, Mm-hmm. Well, we should then expect, well, then God's got to take his children home, because really bad things are going to happen about this. Now, I do want to be careful, too, and we've said this a bunch of times, is that, well, we know from Daniel's testimony that the tribulation is a seven-year event. Mm-hmm. The time of Jacob's troubles does not necessarily have to incorporate all 7 years.
No,
it could just be the last half.
Yeah.
So
it definitely seems like there's a midpoint where things just go from really bad to worse.
Right.
And I think that's kind of going to be the point where, like we were talking about earlier, where that third option gets revoked. That's
correct.
The point
it's
where
exactly
it's,
where
you're
it gets
on this side or you're on that side.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, God's going to, he is committed to removing his children, his troubadours, on Teruah, somewhere along this timeline, recognizing the longer we stay, the better it is for his children. The better it is for everybody.
Sure.
Even for us, gives us purpose.
Yes.
So it's better for everybody, up to the point where we are having to endure the same hellish conditions as everyone else, and I was not going to allow his children to endure those hellish conditions. Well, so if you're following the events, sometime after Israel is cajoled into accepting, forced into accepting this land for peace treaty, this two-state solution, that ends her at the waist and makes her unsustainable as a country. This is what's going to happen. Then it shall be like the gathering in and receiving of a harvest of standing grain. And his sacrificial lamb will reap the harvest of first fruits. And it shall be as one would conduct a gleaning, the first fruits, in the broad valley of Rephaim. So here we have the harvest, and we know that the Teruah is a harvest.
Mm-hmm.
It is an ingathering, a cloth, joining together and bringing in, collecting and then assembling before removing by way of integrating and or ingathering, withdrawing through guidance. It's a harvest, which is a reaping of fruit from the chaff in the proper season. It's katsar, it's here to cut away the branch so as to remove it from the short but extremely vexing time of grief, a time which must be shortened due to the extent of the vexing provocation and uncontrollable anger. And the harvest is of the standing grain, that which is upright and has the ability to stand and rise. Whom to affirm, to validate, to establish. So it's a very specific group of people, those who are upright, not bent over in prayer, those who are standing up and walking to Yahweh along the path that he has provided. We're going to participate in a harvest. And it is his sacrificial lamb, the Zerora, his strong arm and power, which is going to reap that harvest. And we will be his first fruits. And it might be this notion of, wait a minute, first fruits is the third Mikra, you're talking about the fifth. Well, Yosha was the first of the first fruits on Bukurim. We follow on Teruah. It is the third harvest. Amongst the Mikra. Then it shall be as one would conduct a gleaning, a rapid gathering up of what's left, quickly removing all or most of the remaining harvest, speaking of a numerically insignificant ingathering, and implying that such a small amount is collected in relationship to the energy expended to grasp hold of them, that it is it's an extraordinary event for what transpires to make it happen, and yet how few benefit. The first fruits in the broad valley of Rephaim. Rephaim is the dead and departed without material substance, the souls of deceased along the broad and open way. And so we're being removed. Those of us who have chosen to follow the narrow and restrictive way are being removed from the broad and open way. That's what Raphaim conveys. And the gleaning says, there's going to be so few of us, the world's hardly going to notice. I don't know if we'll make the newspaper. Assuming there's going to be a newspaper.
7 billion?
Yeah.
We'll make the Chinese Times.
No.
Peking Times.
No.
Did you know what?
And there isn't a single person among those who will be harvested or gleaned at that time who's noteworthy. Won't be a politician. Won't be a theologian. There won't be a societal superstar. There's nobody that's going to be known. I don't think there's anybody in our the covenant family that I know of that is is known. That the world's going to say, "Wow, can you believe that so and so is gone?" I mean, our dogs might miss us.
I'm hoping they come with.
Yeah, hopefully. I want them to come with. And the young children are going to come with us before the age of accountability. They're going to come with us. And we're hardly going to be missed. That's because we only really matter to one another. And all of us are coming. So, yeah, I don't even know if the world's going to notice. But from what I have, and we've all learned elsewhere, I think we can conclude that the Teruah harvest will be fulfilled as is being described here. Sometime between the early autumn of 2026 and the fall of 2029. Either preceding or during the first 3.5 years of the time of Jacob's troubles. It could occur early on and thus simultaneously with the treaty imposed on Israel at the time world leaders have the nation or leave the nation with no viable option but to capitulate. Or it could occur 1, 2, or even 3 years thereafter, but still before the horrid time of Jacob's troubles commence. So it could be anywhere in that period. But suffice it to say, politicians and statesmen are making the planet more dangerous by capitulating to Islamic terrorism, by attempting to tear Israel apart in the process, something Yahweh will not tolerate. God doesn't intervene very much in human affairs. In fact, I'm translating Mizmor 83 right now, and they're giving two examples of how the psalmist, who I actually think is Dode, Dodekef, in this particular psalm, the psalmist is talking about Yahweh's enemies and the like and everything that's going to transpire, and he gives two examples of times when Yahweh intervened. And I was constantly making the point, as I was writing the commentary for Isaiah 17, is that God's going to intervene here. He is specifically going to intervene. He's going to have a set-apart spirit blow the jihadists away. And I wanted folks to have an appreciation for how seldom that happens. Because, you know, the Christian God intervenes in everything, from nosebleeds to stubbed toes.
Okay.
And he's the God of the... the trivial. Yeah, he picks lottery numbers. I mean, he's really engaged, man. He is the one you have to thank if you get a base hit in a game or kick a field goal. So he is the God of the ridiculously trivial. But the fact of the matter is that God almost never intervenes apart from Israel. And he intervenes with Israel on very few occasions. So the psalmist is saying, yeah, I want you to intervene like you did. And he gave two examples. Whoa. It doesn't happen very often.
So what'd you get, Hezekiah and...
No. No, no, they gave two really interesting examples. And the two examples were peoples who had deliberately led the Israelites astray religiously. You know, Moshe had to deal with the Midianite women who tried to seduce the Israelites into worshiping the Lord of the Light. And so it was strictly the kind of deal where they were trying to encourage Israel to worship false gods. And for that, the consequence of that is far worse than death. And so Yahweh just shortened their lives and said, you know, that's it. And it was interesting because Moshe, in the midst of this, Yahweh just says, you know, I'm done. Kill the men, but you can take the women and children captive if you want. And Moshe said, no, I'm not taking the women captives. They're the ones that were the most responsible for leading the children of Israel into the worshiping of the Lord. I'm not going to leave them alive. Moshe saw to it they were killed. You know, good for him. And then that was just round one of the Midianites. That you also have them come up again when they're working with the Amalekites and they're robbing and plundering Israel, just really ransacking Israel. And you have them on a second go round, this time with Gideon. But the other story, so that's the one is the Midianites, and you know, they get it twice, and they get it twice for tormenting Israel and for trying to encourage Israelites to worship the false god, the Lord of Light, Lord Baal Peor. The second one is really obscure. And if the children of Israel were acting up and they didn't, they just had no appreciation for what Yahweh had done to liberate them from servitude in Egypt. And so he just said, I'll tell you what, maybe you need a little time out. Maybe you need to see what it's like to be controlled by religious leaders. So there was a Canaanite that was the king of Hazor, and Yahweh arranged for them for a brief time to experience once again what it's like to be enslaved by religion and politics. But the chief general, the commander of the king's army, abused them badly. Abused them for 20 years. And God says, yeah, that's way out of line and way too much. And so he arranged for a woman whose name means word, Deborah, Deborah. He said, you're going to be answered through whom? I'm going to take this mighty Canaanite warrior with 900 chariots of iron, and we're going to bring him down through a woman. And you know, she goes out with Balaxonia, the beneficial word, out, and they come home. All 900 war chariots are gone. And the only person that survives is this one general. And he tries to hide in the tent of an allied king, and the wife's there. He falls asleep, and she drives his tent peg through his temple.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what you have is these people that were torturing the children of Israel, done in by women. And you equate it to the story that we're going to hear as we go forward. When Yahweh says, when the you know these Islamic jihadists flood into Israel, the only response is set apart spirit blows them away. This the most anti woman religion in human history is done in by the feminine manifestation of God's nature, which is why I think that they picked those two stories. But the point I was making was just that when David was trying to come up with stories of how God intervened and actually engaged on behalf of Israel, as opposed to trying to teach Israel and guide Israel through the Torah, and so that the Israelites wouldn't make right decisions, they're few and far between. Now, it's been a long time since he intervened. And so things have to get really, really dark for him to intervene, which is what we're going to see here shortly. So here we have the standing grain of the first fruits that are going to be part of this teruah harvest. And now we know the timing of it. When you see the United Nations impose this thinning of Israel and the two-state solution, have your bags packed. Be ready to go. I don't know why you have your bags packed. You're not going to need anything that's in a bag, but you get the gist. Be ready to go.
Metaphorically speaking.
Metaphorically speaking, have your bags packed. And it is kind of interesting that it is the arm of Yahweh that is orchestrating this, since Yosha and the set apart spirit collectively fulfilled the first four Moed Mikra. It makes perfect sense that Yosha would be instrumental in performing and fulfilling the fifth. I don't think Yosha is involved in fulfilling the sixth, because they look at Yahweh, who they have pierced, yes, and they recognize that Yahweh is their God, and they claim His name, and He writes His name in their hearts and His Torah inside of them. So I don't think He fulfills the sixth and the seventh, but He certainly is going to play a role in the fifth. And in Him, there will be a remnant. Now, this is in Him, Jacob. What does Jacob represent? Israel. And in Him, there will be a remnant who will be spared and survive. Gleanings, as in going around and immersing at the right time of year, an olive tree, two or three ripe olives in the top. A branch, four or five on its fruitful branches, which have been cut away, prophetically declares Yahweh, God of Israel. Well, just the end of it. God of whom?
Israel.
What time is this? How do you have replacement theology if, in fact, Yahweh is the God of Israel sometime during the time of Yahshua's troubles, when He is within years of returning?
Mm-hmm.
How is that possible? He's not the God of the Vatican. He's not the God of Roman Catholics. He's not the God of the Church. He's not the God of Gentiles. He's not the God of America. He's the God of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, that's sobering. All right. So, and in Him, in Jacob, in Israel, there will be a remnant who will be spared and will survive. Gleanings, which is a smaller secondary harvest, going around and immersing at the right time of year, which would be at Teruah, and an olive tree. Well, olive tree is the olive because the olive was the best source of light in the ancient world. First form of light for the olive oil. Olives were extremely nutritious as food, therefore sustaining life. Olives were used for their healing properties as an ointment. The longest lived tree in that part of the world was the olive tree. And the olive was synonymous with the anointing of setting somebody apart for service.
Dude.
So the olive represents so many wonderful things. And now it says that two or three ripe olives, so, this is mature fruit. You know, to one way or another, you know, most of us fall into the mature camp. This is mature fruit. We've lived our lives. This is a coming at a really wonderful time for us. Then it says two or three olives in the top branch, four or five on its fruitful branches, which have been cut away, prophetically declares Yahweh. So it is interesting to note that Sha'ar, which can be translated left or leave, remain or survive, also addresses the difference between the soul and the flesh, the inner person and their physical body. So it really sets up this dichotomy of people who are going to be left to endure the time of Yaakov's trouble and those who are being removed so that they don't have to endure it. So we can clearly see this dichotomy between the souls who are part of the covenant family and survive and the men and women who, opposed to the Torah, are left behind. Physical beings have a limited lifespan and they die. My soul's enveloped and they set apart spirit as part of a first fruits harvest endure forever. Now we talked about the olive is especially telling. Produces pure and brilliant light. Smoke-free light, by the way. The enlightening the observant. Benefits, by the way, only occur by design with a vessel and a wick, as well as a spark, which would be the covenant, the word, and the set-apart spirit. With oleah, translated gleanings, we have, I think, some subtle insights also. One is that regarding the illuminating and nourishing nature of olives being spirit at this time, the first of these entails the likelihood that this remnant of the covenant was deliberately left on this tree of life, attached to its branches and rooted in Israel by Yahweh to convey his message to those looking in the right direction at this, the most pivotal moment in human history. We were left there for a reason, and only removed at the last possible moment. Now, second, oleah, likely shaded by alal, we have another interesting distinction between the harvestable olives and those destined to fall on their own and die and rot away. The productive olives will be revealing the foolishness of wanton, abusive, and ruthless rites and practices. And of the rotten olives, I pointed out the ignorance of hypocrisy. So, once again, a dichotomy. It is further interesting. I'll just look at timing here.
Mm-hmm.
This could be, this is obviously going to occur on the first day of the seventh month. So the seventh month, with the first month being the light renewing on the moon surface, in Abib, on the new, kind of newish moon, when lights begin to emerge on the surface of the moon, closest to the vernal equinox. And seven lunar months, the first day of seven lunar months, past that time. The first day of the seventh month when this is going to occur. So in 2026 on the Roman pagan calendar, that commences on a Shabbat at sunset Friday, September 11th. Kind of an interesting day, don't you think? Friday, September 11th.
Shabbat. Very good.
2026, yeah. The following year in 5994 Yah, Teruah begins on a Wednesday, September 1st. In 2028, Teruah runs from sunset on Tuesday, September 19th, through sundown on the 20th. Also, a case could be supported for the previous day. And, you know, again, I don't want to make a religious statement in the sense of, well, this is the only day that could be Teruah. There is the observational. There is the astronomical. and there is the formula that the rabbis have used for a long period of time. And so they all are all close to one another, but you know, Yahweh never bothered to, for reasons that are important for us to understand, set in stone that this is the way that you determine the first day of the month. You know, it's got to be this much light. It's got to be visible at this time. You know, it's observational, not astronomical, for example. And he doesn't do that. And he doesn't do that for a reason. This is not about setting a date in that sense, but understanding the timing of these events and what they represent. But I think with each of those are within a day, if not the day. And, you know, I kind of take a view of my astronomical is slightly different than maybe other people's. There has to be very close, if not a full 1% of renewed reflected light visible on the moon before the sun sets. And if there isn't, then I'm saying that's just not going to count, because a new moon is always looking into the setting sun. And if there's any less than that, the slightest bit of cloud cover or dust or anything in the atmosphere, or just the viewable angle, you know, if you stand and there's anything in the way, you aren't going to see it. You wouldn't notice it. So, you know, I have some kind of my own approach to what I think qualifies, and I don't know if it means anything to anybody, but that's the reason why you might find a day different on this than what I have said. Now, what is interesting here is that the time of Jacob's troubles, it is defined in Jeremiah 37. Now, why that is interesting, we're looking, you know, for timeline here. What happens in Jeremiah 31? Is anybody familiar with a passage in Jeremiah 31 that might be important as it relates to the fulfillment of a Moed Mikre?
The renewal of the covenant?
There's the one. The fulfillment of Yom Kippurim is what is specifically addressed in Jeremiah 31. What is the Moed Mikre that has to be fulfilled before Yom Kippurim is fulfilled?
Teruah.
Teruah, we have to go.
Yeah. What chapter of Yeremiah comes before Yeremiah 31?
Say again?
30, right? So it's 37 that there's a prophetic statement specifically about what we're talking about here. That the time of Jacob's troubles, which is the thing that jettisons this harvest, coincides with a timeline in Yirmiyah of that's what happens immediately before the fulfillment of Yom Kippur. So that in itself is fascinating. Now, I think there's a lot of other interesting things here that, you know, we're talking about, you know, timing and how important four is as a this time of testing, and how many olives are being pulled out of this tree. And so this is just what I thought was so fascinating. I don't know if I'm reading too much into this, but I think there was a reason that Yahweh's depiction of the gleaning and presented two or three and then four or five olives. The smaller number associated with the uppermost and choicest branches, and the larger number with its fruitful branches, which have been cut away. I think it's designed to identify, to quantify, and distinguish the relatively small number of individuals who will be taken home. The smaller number of the two communities, I think, represents the Israelites, the direct descendants of Jacob. That's the uppermost branch of that tree. They're going to be reaped at this time. The larger figure, most likely, represents Goyim, Gentiles, who will be gleaned as adopted children as a result of embracing the conditions of the covenant affirmed through Jacob and for giving rise to successive generations of Yah's children, making this harvest even possible. both participants in the secondary harvest of some 7,000 souls, 2 plus 5 or 3 plus 4, the lower number and the higher number, the higher number and the lower number, mm-hmm. they both total 7.
Mm-hmm.
The naturally born and the adopted will leave the earth on the Mikra of Teruah, following the destruction of Damascus and the thinning of Israel, but likely before the final Islamic assault against God's people and land. That is revealing.
Yeah.
We know when. We know how many.
What?
We know from whence they will come. We know why they were allowed to stay and why they're being removed at this time. Now, it's astonishing how much you can learn if you just try.
Well, didn't you always say that prayer answers all your questions?
It does. I mean, how many times do we have people who write us and say, I've got these series of questions? We said, I'm telling you, if you take the time to read, it'll all be answered. Right. Torah means teaching. They're all answered. Kirk, before the show began, you were talking about something that you found in the rewrite of this chapter that you really found to be amazing. I did too. And we're not going to get into any detail of it today. We probably won't even get into it a week from today. It'll take us a little more time. But I was doing my best to explain exactly who the belligerents were and when this was occurring as we go through, because there are some really bold, powerful statements in Yahshua 17. I mean, it doesn't fool around. I mean, it is the most extraordinary series of events detailed in all of prophecy. Yeah, I'm always amazed as to how people focus on all these things they think are important prophetically. They have nothing more important than what we're reading in Yahshua 17 and 18.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had thought that, man, what if we just take a moment and look at some of the interesting words that were there. And one of the most interesting words that I decided I was going to chase down was Leom. And Leom's only used 20 times. And the first three happened to be in conjunction with Esau and Jacob. And then it shows up again in a passage in Yirmiyah that details this same invasion. And it's such an unusual term that I said, it's going to go. Where it is brought up and how it's introduced and how it's used in conjunction with all this, because I was unfamiliar with the term. And it's just translated nations. Well, that doesn't do it justice, because there are a lot of Hebrew words for nation. And I started doing it and found out that it came up three different times in the account of what was going to happen with the belligerents in Rebekah's womb between Esau and Jacob. And there's one of those prophecies there that is so ingrained in Christendom that no one bothers to think, wait a minute, that's not what the words actually say. You know how the one that says that the older is going to be ruled over by the younger? And Christians embrace that and say, that's us. We're the younger one. And so we're going to rule over the older one, which is is Israel. But that's not what the words say. The words actually say that the more numerous and the most militant is going to serve the lowly and little.
Yeah,
and then you're going, oh, wait a minute. This went from a statement that has never been true to a statement that's profound. And then Yahweh uses a series of a half a dozen words to describe Esau. And the first of those words was just one that just instantly goosebumps. And we're going to get into it. I guess I'm just teasing now because you brought it up, Kirk, and when you read it, it's, you had the same effect. Just your jaw just drops down to your chest. And so how have we missed this all this time? But it's, don't have to do any historical searches. There's no extrapolations. The words themselves describe exactly who Esau represents and why God hates him. And so we're going to find so many things that are just mind-blowing as we go through what's going to happen in the detail that we've been given. But the thing that I most wanted to cover today was that we know the size of the true harvest. We know who's going to participate in the true harvest. We know when it's going to occur. We know what's going to happen along in terms of the major events in human history that are going to precede it. And we have affirmation after affirmation that the text we are studying was inspired by Yahweh. This is really, really good stuff.
You ain't kidding.
I think we had someone that wrote the other day that said, you know, I know Yahweh, and I know I'm part of the covenant family. I'm observing the Mikra, but, you know, something just doesn't feel right. And we got a wonderful letter from J.K. trying to help this person on the feelings. I'm not very good at that stuff. You know, I'm a thinker, not a feeler. It's not to say that feelings are important. It's just that I'm driven by
words,
by thinking, and by thinking, I don't care how I feel. How I feel is irrelevant.
I know.
It's what I know that matters. Mm-hmm. And this is testimony that provides knowledge that leads to understanding that for anybody who's open-minded and rational, total and complete conviction. So, Kirk, you were the one that said, let's go do this.
I didn't hope you didn't mind, but today. I mean, it needs to be heard. I thought it just fabulous.
Yeah, and it's going to take us a while to get through it, because right now we're around page 29 of what is less than a third of the way through. And, and we have a lot of material to go through before.
Everybody should read this. This is really terrific. So.
Yeah, it's, and we skipped about 90% of the insights that can be gleaned from it, because we just really focused on the testimony of Yah itself says. But this was an old chapter. I wrote it 5 years ago, and taking a completely different approach to it, and really tried to turn over every single letter of every single word, and contemplate what they meant, and then the words that were so unique to this prophecy, like Leom. Chase it down. Find out where else it's used, and how does it shed light on what's happening here. Another great one is the reference to tumbleweeds, almost as if they were balls of dung being blown away by the spirit. So, that wasn't the only place that the spirit is blowing away these little balls of dung as if they were tumbleweeds. And come to find out, the other one is specifically addressing UN Resolution 242 and the United Nations and of the world conspiring not just to destroy Israel, but such that the name Israel is never spoken again.
Good luck.
Okay. How did I miss that?
Take your shot, pal.
You just take your best shot. See how it works for you.
See how that turns out.
Take your best shot. Just check and see how it turns out for you. Anyway.
Well, thank you for your hard work. We appreciate it. All of us who have just...
it's so much fun. You know, I'm
going, wow, this is just...
Yeah, I'm finally, settled now. My life is settled. I'm really content down here in South Florida. It's just a wonderful time. And for the first time now in this... enough time each day to translating and writing and studying that my left shoulder where I broke my collarbone those years ago is screaming at me because I'm doing it so much. I've got to get back into sitting down and typing all day shape because I got way too active. It's hard for me to do, but I've put a lot of hours in and loving it. It's you know, there's something about it. I think, JB, you've done it, and Kirk, you've done it. Where it doesn't matter what's happening the rest of your life. It doesn't matter if the world's burning up around you. It doesn't matter who's threatening or, you know, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. When you're in the process of studying Yah's testimony, listening to what he has to say and thinking about it, it's just all good. It's just reinforcing, invigorating, lightening. It's just every possible good thing.
Yeah. I think you described it once. You said it perfectly. It's a high. I mean, it really
it's
is.
It's a high. Yeah, it is. It is an enlightening, uplifting high. You know, it's one of the things I try to tell everybody that when they first hear this and they hear me saying, you know, that God is unreligious and that, you know, Paul was a scallywag and Muhammad was a scumbag and all religions lead away from God. And yet what I've done here is I've translated the Dead Sea Scrolls and Hebrew into English and then they say, oh God, so you've got, you know, your own little religious thing going. I said, no. Mm-hmm. No, there's what you're going to find is that story is enormously enlightening. It is uplifting. It's a love story. You know, it's empowering. It's the antithesis of everything religious. And it is every positive thing that you can contemplate. It's that all rolled into one.
It really is. It really is. Well said. Well said, yeah. Man.
Yeah, good. God's a cool dude. But I'll tell you what, he also he does not like it when people abuse his children. So you don't want to be on the bad side. I will tell you that. We're coming to a time where as fun as he is, as lighthearted as he is, as easy as he is to get along with, as just much fun as he is to be around, there's going to be a brief period of like 3 to 4 years that you don't want to be on his bad side. I will tell you that for sure.
We're going to see that dark side.
Mm-hmm. We are. Yeah, we are. All right, fellas. JB, did you do anything about your job, or still waiting?
Still up in the air. One of those, I know somebody else who got a job there. He said it was like 4 months after he interviewed before he heard anything else from him. So.
Okay.
Good luck.
All right, well, let us know when you know.
Not out of luck either, so I will.
Okay. Well, happy Shabbat. Right, we'll be back this time next week.
Yes, sir. Shalom, shalom.
Good night, y'all.
Shalom. Good night.
Bye.
Bye.
There we go. Johannes was right here the whole time.